Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Stuart Onan, whose latest novel is Songs for the Missing, one of 11 novels. Earlier novels include Last Night at the Lobster, Snow Angels, The Good Wife, A Prayer for the Dying. There's a book called Faithful. Two die-hard Boston Red Sox fans chronicle the historic 2004 season, written with Stephen King. Another nonfiction book, The Circus Fire, and a collection of short stories, In the Walled City. Stuart Onan, each of your books is different, but many of your books seem to follow a certain theme, which was discussed in a 1998 interview, how horrible things happen to people, often without reason. And Songs for the Missing really ties into that.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's the grace under pressure there. A lot of the books, the early books especially, we're talking back in 98, were pretty dire in their circumstances. Lately, that hasn't been the case with, say, Last Night at the Lobster. In a way, The Good Wife is not quite dire. It opens dire, but then sort of talks about just, you know, everyday stuff. So I've been sort of getting away, I think, a little bit from the horrible things happening. But yes, in Songs for the Missing, it's tough.
This one concerns a girl named Kim Larson who disappears. The characters live near Erie, Pennsylvania. The book occurs over the course of several years and follows the parents of Kim, Ed and Fran, and her younger sister, Lindsay, as well as her kind of boyfriend and best friend as they deal with this. It struck me that while its stories are character-driven or plot-driven, this one is something else. It's almost event-driven because there is a certain framework to following what happens when someone goes missing.
Yeah, there's a natural progression of events. And so, in hopes of getting Kim back, they have to follow that formula almost. And yet it doesn't really help them finally. Although at times it seems to bring them closer together. The book, in the end, I think, is more about how we're sort of mysteries to each other.
As opposed to the mystery of what happened to Kim.
Exactly, yeah. So it's kind of a bait and switch in a way, that we think we're going to get one kind of book when we open up, and as the book goes on, what we are delivered is a much different kind of book. And I hope it's a deeper book for it. But I do that in some of the earlier books, too. You think you're getting one thing, and in the end, you're given something completely different.
What was the derivation of the book? Where did it come from?
Well, I've been writing about missing people for a long time, probably since I began writing in the 80s. We're going to miss everybody, you know, as Salinger famously says at the end of Catcher. The people that are closest to us are going to go away. And sometimes in life, those people are very close to you and suddenly they're gone. And how we deal with that and how we continue on has always been I've had a real fascination for that, you know, that idea of endurance in the face of the very worst. I've been working on this particular book for about 10 years. I tried to get at that material sort of head on several times and started books and got, you know, well into them. And another character would sort of arc across the path and it would turn into a whole different book. Wish You Were Here began from this book. Parts of The Night Country began from this book. And this time when I started writing it back in, I think, 2005, I found a way in. I found a way into the material and found a way into Kim and all the people around her. And suddenly everybody around her, very close to her, became fascinating to me. And that's usually when you know you've got something.
Well, when you say that these books, Wish You Were Here and Night Country, came out of this, what do you mean by that?
I was writing about the small town where Kim had been abducted from. And during the course of writing about that small town, Emily, who's the protagonist, one of the protagonists of Wish You Were Here, drove through the town. And she was driving through the town, and I was sort of like, you know, reading her mind and trying to figure out what she's doing up here in the, you know, northeastern corner of Ohio where nobody is anymore. And I began to follow her and make up her story and the people closest to her. And all of those people closest to her became fascinating. And so I said, so I followed there. You follow where the heat is. You know, you go with the hot hand.
Well, when you say you follow it, is it still just like taking long walks if you've been writing at the same time?
Oh, you're writing it. You're writing. You're discovering it as you're writing it. That's why, I mean, sometimes you make a plan and you say, you know, this is what I want to write about. I'm going to write about, you know, an abandoned amusement park that's brought back to life and a doomed ride, blah, blah, blah. You know, and you get the town, you get the city, you get the people, and you start writing it, and it doesn't come alive. But as you're writing it, something else might come alive. And so you look at that sort of, you know, the vibrancy of it and the heat of it, and you go after that and you start writing that way.
Well, in Songs for the Missing, is there anything where you looked and you said, oh, I could take a right turn, and instead you took a left turn to stay within the context of the book?
No, because the book, as you know, having read it, you know that it's rather loosely connected in a way.
Right.
It's not a heavily plotted book, even though we have this great imbalance at the front part of it.
That's why I say it's event-driven rather than plot-driven.
Yeah. Well, it's actually, I want to think that it's sort of, you know, emotional or mood-driven in a way. There's the juxtaposition between sections that, you know, doesn't happen in a heavily plotted book where you have to go boom, 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 here's your climax, boom, 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 and we're leading you towards these climaxes. This is just how these people feel after this has happened, and they don't know where they're going with it.
Night Country is about a car accident and ghosts as observers. How did that come out of Songs for the Missing?
Again, the main character that I began writing when I first tried to write Songs for the Missing was the sheriff in this very small town of Conneaut, Kingsville, Ashtabula, Ohio. And as he was going through town, he passed the parking lot where the young boy, maybe 13, 14 years old, developmentally disabled, is corralling all the shopping carts. And I kept that sort of character in mind, even though I trashed all the writing that I'd done from that section. I remembered that kid, and going back to that kid let me into the world of the Night Country.
In Songs for the Missing, then, you're trying to shape it early on. At what point, I mean, what was the problem that you were having that you finally solved? And we got Songs for the Missing as the result.
I think it was that I was focusing too much on the actual event and the actual, you know, mystery of what happened to Kim Larson. When what was really more important to me and to, I think, to the people within the book is how their lives changed. How the loss of Kim changed the way that they saw the world and saw themselves. Lives are changed by that. It's not simply that Kim disappeared and what happened to her, because that can't be changed. But what happens within these people as they go through the days and how they treat each other, how well they know each other, do they come to understand each other or not better because of this event or worse?
The parents, her parents, stay close, which is kind of an alternative to what we see in most stories that take this path. A lot of stories are about missing girls and we find out what happens. In this case, and frequently families fall apart. In this case, the family doesn't fall apart.
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with who they are, where they came from, how they feel about each other. And they go through some tough, tough times because people grieve at very different rates there. And the way that Fran sort of, you know, becomes this sort of almost an advocate for Kim and for missing children and for everything. She becomes this professional, not victim, I'd say, but professional, hopeful person, you know, whereas as Ed just wants to sort of retreat from everything. So one becomes much more public, the other becomes much more private. And that split between them almost breaks them apart.
You said before that it's all about the process of discovery. Does that mean you're just kind of writing and just seeing where it goes and then saying, well, you know, Ed wouldn't do this, so therefore it affects JP, the boyfriend, in a certain way?
Well, you say, you know, this is how Fran feels about JP. What does JP feel about that? You know, JP knows that Fran hates him because of the secrets that he kept, and she sees that as getting in the way of the investigation, possibly getting Kim back. So her intolerance for JP certainly shapes the way that JP goes forward in his life. He wants to approach the Larsons again and again. He wants to go and apologize to them again and again because he feels he's done nothing wrong, and yet he still feels guilty. And it changes his life. It changes the way that he sees himself. He can no longer see himself as a certainly not a good person, but he can't see himself as a blameless person anymore, and it takes a toll on him.
There's also this odd subplot, which never quite develops, I would guess deliberately, involving this other person who has sex with Kim, so that if we're expecting a thriller, we expect it to move in that direction. In fact, we expect that character to appear and play a role, but you stay away from it. Why?
Yeah. Woos, or Dennis Wozniak, has had a relationship with Kim, and is it ongoing or not? We don't know. Even Kim's best friends don't really know. It's a part of Kim that is, again, a mystery. And the book is about how much we do or don't know about the people that are closest to us. You know, Kim has lived with the Larsons her entire life, and yet some of the things that they find out after she disappears, they had no clue were going on. They might have suspected some of them, but certainly not all of them. So again, it's how we're all a mystery to one another.
The opening chapter is Kim's story. It's hard to say who she is. One criticism of the book said that we don't get emotionally involved enough because we don't know. But in your perspective, that's absolutely deliberate.
Kim is many different people, and as she says, and I think it's the very first paragraph of the book, she was hoping to become someone else. She's only 18 years old. She's not fully formed.
And she's about to leave for school.
She's about to leave for college. She hasn't figured out who she is or who she wants to be. She just knows she doesn't want to be this person from this small town, which is natural when you're 17 or 18 years old. It's the last summer that she's spending there, and she's so looking forward to getting out of there.
Well, also, she and JP are boyfriend-girlfriend, but neither of them expects this to last.
No, it's not a serious relationship, certainly on Kim's side of things. JP wishes it were a little more serious because he has some difficulty in seeing himself as a romantic object to begin with. So the Kim that we find in all these little different sort of bits and pieces often are contradictory. And Lindsay feels further and further away from what she thinks of as the real Kim. She thinks the real Kim has kind of been forgotten.
Well, I notice your earlier novels, along with being very dark, also tend toward melodrama at times, and yet as your career goes on, there's a movement away from that.
Yeah, I mean, the clashes that the characters have in the earlier books are more overt. I don't know if I'd go melodramatic on it, because some of them are written, I mean, certainly Speed Queen's a satire, so it's always written with,
right,
you know, a grain of salt. And some of the sort of more metafictional tricks of Snow Angels, I think, keep Snow Angels from being too sort of overheated in a way, because the narrator is a concoction of the other narrator and all that. The later books have been quieter, there's no doubt, and again, more concerned with endurance.
Most writers will just go, okay, now I need to turn the screws. There's a sense that the screws are about to be turned, and then you go, uh-uh, I'm not going to turn them, and you unturn them.
Well, I don't know if it's turning or unturning. I'm trying, I think, to be more responsive to and responsible to the characters' lives. I think if you stay true to the characters and to their world, you really can't go wrong. It's up to the reader, of course, to say, you know, I'm invested in these characters, you know, they're worthy of and capable of love, and therefore I'm going to follow them wherever we go. And you hope that there are readers that will do that, and then will bring their own views of their life and the people closest to them and bring that into play and make the book that much richer for them. And you hope that there are readers out there, and, you know, from the early reactions to this, yes, there are those readers. But there are other readers that want a thriller. Other readers say, hey, I've been promised a thriller, I want a thriller. You know, you got to give it to me, you got to show me how she was killed and where, and, you know, and really go over it in detail. Do the CSI, I want to see flashbacks, I want to see, you know, funky lights, you know, I want to see forensic stuff. Life often doesn't work that way.
The book really, on some level, is about lack of closure. Even by the time the closure happens, they can't close.
Well, of course not. Of course not. You'll never have closure for anything like that. Never. No, I think that's a complete illusion that you could have closure, or that it's a dramatically satisfying ending because we find out exactly how the young girl got murdered. That's completely bogus and has nothing to do with real life. So in this way, this is sort of an antidote to that whole sort of CSI culture, which we've been living with now for, I mean, how many years has that damn show been on and how many different iterations? That's not the way life is.
Stuart Onan, frequently when people are writing a book like Songs for the Missing, where you're kind of discovering how the characters are, certain characters that you didn't expect take a greater role in the book. Was there any character who you felt that just kind of said to you, I'm more important?
Well, I think certainly in the back half of the book, Lindsay sort of takes over and becomes really the focal character here because she sees a way out. It may be a false way out. It's the way that Kim saw out. She's going to go away to college and she's going to leave this behind. And it's kind of a heartbreaking choice that she makes. She sort of divorces herself emotionally from a lot of things, including, you know, the memory of Kim. But she's got to look to the future. She's got to keep going. She's not heartless about it, I don't think. But there's a toughness about her that wasn't there before. When Kim disappeared, she was 15 and sort of the nerd, and, you know, she was happy to sort of be by herself in the room. And now she's sort of going out into the world and saying, you know, I've got to carry everything myself.
Well, she was also in Kim's shadow, and suddenly she's on her own.
Even after Kim disappears, she's even more in Kim's shadow. She's even more forgotten at that point. And I think that's part of why she chooses to sort of separate herself.
When you were researching this, I understand you went online, you read blogs. What other kinds of research did you do?
Unfortunately, a good friend of mine, the mother of her partner, went missing. They went through the entire search process, and it did not turn out happily. So I spoke a lot with her about it. I read books of people who'd had children abducted and killed. A lot of really sort of, you know, horrible stuff. Really, really bad stuff. But again, that the more human side of this particular event, when we see it on, say, 48 Hours Mystery or 2020 or something like that, we basically get the sort of the cut and dried, case description, when in fact these are things that people have to live with, day in, day out for years and years and sometimes forever. So I wanted to do the story behind the story, the real story, and how it really felt. Are there readers out there that were like clamoring for that? Hell no. I want to feel how it feels to have a child abducted and never get that child back. No, but I thought it was an important story. And also, I liked that small town where Kim had come from so much. I'd always sort of wanted to go back there. I mean, I'd written so much about it, and I felt so close to it. In that northeast corner of Ohio where I've been going there for 40 years.
Why?
I worked at a camp up, and my brother's on the board of the camp, and my children go to the camp. My father went to the camp. So I'd always go up through Conneaut, up through there, and I always thought it was sort of a fascinating little town to write about. And so I sort of got to indulge myself and sort of live in that town for a couple years. Typical American, boring, small town, failing economically. It's an exit. It's the first exit in Ohio off I-90 there. And that's why, to me, it's absolutely fascinating.
Even a place like Ashtabula, which is the armpit of the nation, according to some people. I mean, it's not an armpit in the sense that it's like Butte, Montana's an armpit, because Butte is maybe the ugliest place I've ever been. But it's an armpit in that there's no there.
Well, there's a lot of there, but it's not a there that's exciting. There's not a there that says, oh, boy, I'm just dying to live in Ashtabula, Ohio, or, gee, there's a great job opening in Ashtabula, Ohio. It's just not there. So the people that grow up there, they want to get out of there, but there's definitely a there. There's a place there. Coming from Pittsburgh, PA, and when I wrote Snow Angels back in the early 90s, I'd never seen the area that I lived in reflected in serious American fiction. Never. Same thing with Last Night at the Lobster. I'd never seen work at a chain restaurant be seriously reflected in American literature. It's always sort of taken as a joke, or this is for losers. This is where the bums are. This is silly.
The movies are always comedies.
Yeah, and ugly comedies, broad comedies, comedies that don't take into any account the humanity of the people that live there. But again, it's reflecting a part of America that I think is a lot of America out there, but hasn't really been shown in our recent fiction, because our recent fiction is a little more fantastic. Well, it's always going to be cosmopolitan. You always want to write about New York and Hollywood and the big cities and things like that, and young people and exciting people and adventurous people and wacky people, quirky people. That's not most of us in America. It's not. We live in, towns like Youngstown or Pittsburgh or Conneaut. That doesn't mean that there shouldn't be a literature about that.
As you talk about that, I keep thinking of two things. One is the times that we live in, escapist times, because the past 8 years have been so dreadful, we don't want to focus on what's real. The other thing is that you began by writing short stories, and the writers that you read were people who wrote about that kind of life, Cheever, Flannery O'Connor, and Carver.
I think more of like a Sherwood Anderson. I mean, Ohio right there. I think that's where my feeling for writing small-town America probably comes from more than anything else. But again, I don't know if it's not a reaction against sort of the fantastic escapist writing that's going out there. But I do think that, the country is worth writing about. And there are a lot of stories out there that sort of haven't been written yet about sort of just regular people.
One thing missing from this book is the politics of the nation as a whole.
Oh, well, the war is throughout this book. Yeah, the Iraq War. I mean, Woos is multiple tours over there, and the very first chapter they talk about people that have been there and have come back.
But there's no opinion about it.
There's no sort of, moralizing or proselytizing about it, but it's there. I mean, obviously, the market that is just killing Ed in the real estate market and his sort of...
That's there, yeah.
Oh, my gosh, is that there? And that's his major worry is about... He's a realtor, and he worries about the market, which has just been destroyed there. And I believe at the last memorial service, one of the people is sort of railing against the Democrats. And Lindsay hears that and is just like, oh, my God, not again. It's the uncle that drives the Escalade. So it's in there. It's always in there as subtext, no doubt. I think that the politics that are within, especially the last three books, the politics are front and center about who's left behind, especially in the last 8 years of America.
Stuart Onan, let's talk a little about your career. You start out as an engineer.
Aerospace, yes.
Were you writing all the time anyway?
Yeah. I'd come home and I'd write in my basement and I'd write stories. I wrote a first novel you know, in my basement after work. Terrible, terrible book. Just awful.
And you had been reading these short story writers.
I've been reading just a lot of everything. When I first started trying to write short stories, I looked at models. And so I'd look at sort of, you know, the classic modern American writers, obviously, you know, O'Connor and Cheever. And I also looked at just who is writing right now. I'd pick up that sort of Best American Short Story collection or the Pushcart Prize collection or the O. Henry collection. I'd go through there, and I'd find a writer whose story I really liked, Charles Baxter, Harmony of the World, great story. And I'd grab that guy, and I'd say, okay, what else has that person written? And I go out and I try to find everything that they'd written. One reason why I'm so excited to be here in Berkeley is that this was the former home of the great Leonard Michaels,
right,
one of my very, very favorite writers. I recently went back and I reread everything that he'd written, including the journals and even the later stuff. Just spectacularly good. You know, he could write to the heart. You know, he could write the skin of life. He could write emotion. He could write about how people are feeling. I don't know if there are people like that out there right now. I mean, I wish there were more of them, maybe.
You have 11 novels, and each of them is very different. What prompted you to start writing Snow Angels, and how did that one differ from everything else you'd done in that you were able to actually get published and become a published writer, you think?
The story collection had won the Drew Hines Prize. So with that prominence, I was able to get a different agent. And that agent then, I had three novels done at that point, and they just chose the first one, Snow Angels. They liked it the best, and they took that and got it published within like 2 weeks. They said, sure, we'll take it. So just the fact that there had been sort of the stamp of approval on the story collection that said, you know, yes, this person can write, you know, that made a big difference in New York.
Snow Angels became a film not too long ago, directed by David Gordon Green, who's since directed Pineapple Express. How did that film come about?
Well, for years, I guess, people had optioned it and wanted to do it, and they were just trying to find the right person to direct it. And Jesse Peretz was going to direct it. And they had him all lined up, but then he got busy, and they had asked David to write a script for it because, his work with both All the Real Girls and Undertow showed that he was pretty good around small towns. He had, you know, the ability to do some violent scenes without making them laughable. David was writing the script, and Jesse sort of bailed out, and so they asked David, you know, would you also like to direct this? Which was wonderful because that's exactly what it needed. It needed a writer-director to take it on. And he did a very, very nice job with it. I was very pleased.
Did you have any input on the screenplay?
No, yeah, none. I wanted to stay away from it completely.
Did you have any contact with the people, Kate Beckinsale, Sam Rockwell, anybody?
Nope, not at all. Although they said that Rockwell carried the novel around with him throughout the shooting, which I thought was kind of neat. He also carried a Bible around with him to get into this character Glenn. And I was really, really pleased. They got the tone of it right. Yeah, there were a lot of changes that I would have done differently, but they're two separate things, the book and the movie, two completely separate things. And the performance of Olivia Thirlby as Lila was just spectacular. She's amazing. She's going to be, I think, just a major, major actress. I've seen her now in three different things, in Juno, in Snow Angels, and in an indie film called The Secret. Magnificent young actress.
You've got some interesting books. I mean, each book varies. Speed Queen, in particular.
It's a weird book.
Very, very strange book. Originally, Stephen King's name was in the title.
Yeah. Originally, the title was Dear Stephen King.
Did you know him at the time?
No. That's how I got to know him. It's a wacky satire, just very, very Tarantino, very Vanishing Point. Weird, weird, weird-ass book. I thought Dear Stephen King was the right title because it announced that this was not going to be the normal Stuart Onan novel or story collection. It's not going to be sort of that sort of blue-collar fiction. It was going to be sort of way out there. You know, we had a little flap about that, and it ended up being called The Speed Queen. It's about American appetites, our desire for things that are probably not good for us.
And it's a female killer answering questions by a writer, by Stephen King.
Yes. He's paid for the rights to her life story, and in her moments before execution in Oklahoma, she answers this in one very long marathon session. So it's about lying. It's about how we frame stories, how we try to make ourselves look better than we are. It was just a lot of fun. It was a goofy, goofy, goofy fun novel. I had a lot of fun doing it. After writing the very heavy, heavy stuff from Names of the Dead, the Vietnam War novel, which a lot of research, a lot of responsibility to the guys that had been there, and I felt that very deeply. And so when I was done with that, I just sort of cut loose and wrote this very irresponsible, psychotic thing. Weirdly enough, it's mirrored in an odd way by Prayer for the Dying, where I have a character who is trying to be utterly responsible in the midst of, you know, an impossible situation, and ends up, through his idea about responsibility, being just as destructive.
Well, I noticed that if you want to talk about the Stuart Onan war novels, we've got Civil War, Prayer for the Dying, we have World War II, A World Away, and now we've got, in a way, Iraq.
In Names of the Dead, which is Vietnam, the father there was a POW in World War II. Growing up in the 1960s and early 1970s, war was always sort of hovering around us in an odd way, in that it wasn't happening right here.
Right.
It was happening over there. That's always sort of affected me. Certainly A World Away, about the home front during World War II, is about how we can live here in peace and luxury while the rest of the world burns.
And Songs for the Missing, in that sense, is the home front in Iraq.
It is, in a way. And again, that idea of Wu's being sort of the most mysterious character. We know almost nothing about this guy.
He never puts in an appearance.
No, he's never there. Well, he's there live once, in that Fran sees him. She's sitting in her car. She sees him at Kim's grave. And he's got his pickup truck there with the Marine decal on the back window of the pickup truck. He leaves flowers, but he also leaves a Kit Kat bar. And that little gesture, I think, makes him more than sort of just this, you know, boogeyman, this warlike gun nut thing. Again, it's what we don't know.
The Good Wife reminds me, in a way, also has a connection to Songs for the Missing, in that, once again, we've got people over a long period of time dealing with their lives, following through it with something going on in the background.
Well, you know, Patty's husband, Tommy, is in prison for 25 to life for murder, for his part in a murder. We're not sure exactly what part he played, but obviously he was in the wrong place and should have been doing that. And she has to have somehow the faith and determination to hold everything together. And she wants to hold her family together. She doesn't want to move out of her little town because it's all she knows. She doesn't want to give that up. So she sort of, you know, buckles down and gets it done year after year after year, and it's not easy and it's very painful. But that's what she's looking forward to. She thinks if she can just hang in there long enough and bring him back home and get him back home, that she'll be satisfied. In the end, he does come home, but I think even in the end, we're not quite sure what their future might be. But I think it's, for her, it's a great achievement. I think, like Manny in Last Night at the Lobster, like the Larsons in Songs for the Missing, I think Patty is a person who is put in an impossible situation, has very few resources, and yet finds a way to endure.
I know that when I try to find themes with writers, most of them just back off and say, if I got into that, I'd get lost because I just have to let whatever happens, happens. Do you feel the same way?
I guess. I mean, you're always trying to be true to the character, but, I mean, obviously it's going to be about what you think is important in life. And when I made a decision to show Manny and this very last night at the Red Lobster that's being shut down, I was making a conscious decision that this is, to me, what I want the reader and what I want the rest of the world to think about for, you know, the 150 pages or so. This is what I think is important, you know. And I don't think you can get away from that. You're not going to be different every book with a different theme, because you're always going to be somewhat the same person. I mean, you change over time, but I mean, your concerns are going to be, I think, there and set there from, you know, maybe early adulthood.
The Night Country, again, moving off in a new direction in terms of the supernatural.
A ghost story. Yeah. Well, I've, you know, growing up with horror comics and, you know, Ray Bradbury, Harlan Ellison, Richard Matheson, all the great sort of...
All three of whom I've interviewed, by the way.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic writers.
Oh, yeah.
And so much imagination. And it was a different way of looking at a small town. And I wanted to write a book about the suburbs. And so I thought, how do I write a book about the suburbs and about this car crash? Because there had been this rash of car crashes. And the more that I looked into it, the more that I found almost every suburban community had their little car tragedy. And so I said, how do I write this? How do I get around sort of the natural maudlin material there? And I had to find a new or different way in. And Bradbury gave me that different way in. The ghost story gave me a different way in. And it helped me sort of undercut, you know, some of the melodrama and sentimentality of it.
When you have an idea and you're going, well, wait a second, this idea has been done before, is there a tendency to put it aside, or a tendency to sit there and go, oh, my God, how am I going to do this?
Well, if you're interested in something that's been done before, you say, I'd better be able to do this better, or I better be able to find more in there or different things in there than the other people have. What is important about this story? You know, when I wrote the Names of the Dead, it's a Vietnam novel that I wrote in the mid-90s, and I said, you know, what has been done before and what has not been done before? And I found there was very, very little written about the Vietnam veteran back from the war years after. Very, very little of it. And I was sort of shocked at that. So I went back in and I started looking. I mean, Tim O'Brien has Speaking of Courage. It's a great, great story from the things they carried. A little bit in Paco's story. But other than that, there really wasn't too much that wasn't kind of cliched. And so I sort of said, you know, how do I get into this? How do I do this differently?
Well, the part of Songs for the Missing that struck me that never been done before is every time in stories like this where the family is in, the family learns stuff. In this one, the family doesn't learn stuff.
The family learns how much it doesn't know.
That's right, yeah.
As we all do throughout life.
They're shut out.
Yeah, and that's the great, I think the most painful thing about the book is that a lot of characters realize how little understood they are by the people that are closest to them, and it hurts.
Your two nonfiction books, The Circus Fire, you moved to Connecticut and learned that there was this incredible fire in 1944 and did your own research?
Yeah, it was so strange. The Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey, the greatest show on earth, their big top burned to the ground in July of 44, killing 167 people. I found this out when I was researching for A World Away because it happened during World War II, and I saw some pictures in an old Life magazine. And so when I moved to Hartford, I said, hey, that's where this weird fire happened. So I went to the library. I said, hey, you know, give me a book about this fire. And they're like, you know, we don't have one. I said, well, let's interloan one. Get one from the other library. Like, no, there isn't one. And I said, that's crazy. You got to be out of your mind. Something like that happens. No one written a book about it. So I put an ad in the paper around Thanksgiving and said, anyone with any information about this, get in touch with me. And just hundreds of people.
Really?
Hundreds of people. Everybody had a story. People had stories about how they didn't go to the circus that day. So that's how big it was. Even if you weren't there, it affected you.
Faithful, which you wrote with Stephen King.
Yeah, that was just good timing. I just finished up a novel, and I had an editor in New York who's a big Yankee fan. Big Yankee fan. And he knows I'm a big Red Sox fan. But as a Red Sox fan, I knew, and he knew as a Yankee fan, that the 2004 Red Sox were at a position to either go big or go home. This was it. They'd gotten Schilling. They'd gotten Folk. They got a brand new manager who had a losing record with the Phillies. Expectations are really high. So whatever happened, it was going to be interesting. They were either going to completely, you know, the wheels were going to fly off, or they might win it all. I just wanted to write a book about how it feels to be a Red Sox fan.
So this started way before 2004. You knew it was going to happen.
Well, Stephen King and I had been keeping a blog about the Red Sox back in 2002. With his two sons, Joe Hill and Owen King. And, you know, every game we'd just be going back and forth and adding stuff. We got really excited about the Sox. And so when 2004 rolled around, and I think it was in February, maybe January, my agent said, well, you know, this editor thinks this might be a good year for the Red Sox book. Do you want to write a Red Sox book this year? And I was like, you know. And I said, you know, I'll write it, but I'll only write it if Steve can write some of it. And he was like, oh, that'd be great. That'd be wonderful. And I was like, well, I don't know if he's going to really get into it. So I called him, and he said, you know, I'm finishing up the Dark Tower series. I'm really, really busy right now. I can't really contribute that much. I was like, don't worry about it. You contribute, you know, 5%, 10%. We'll put your name real small on the cover. It'll be Stuart Onan with Stephen King at the bottom, you know, and that will bring in some extra readership, and we'll have fun going back and forth. And in the first half of the season, that's pretty much how it was. But in the second half, he'd finished up Dark Tower. He got real interested in the season, and we're just going back and forth every day. And, you know, it was a typical Red Sox season. You know, middle of the season, we're down 10.5 games. We got hot in August. We roared back. We won the wild card. We came in. We beat the Angels handily. And then we got our, you know, in the first three games, we just got our asses handed to us by the Yankees. And at that point, it was about to end like any Red Sox season. And the book would have been utterly complete because that's how it feels. Some days you're way, way up. Some days you're way, way down. In the end, bad things happen. You're like, you know, we fought hard, and we'll be back next year. And then, you know, sort of that crazy, unexpected miracle happened. They won 4 straight, and, you know, the Cardinals sort of just weren't even there in the World Series. And, of course, at that point, you know, we were very excited because, like, wow, you know, our book's going to be, you know, big, big seller. It's big, exciting. It's got Stephen King. It's got the world champion Red Sox, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, at that point, every single sports writer in America suddenly said, hey, I'm going to write a book about the 2004 Red Sox. But, of course, we had, you know, a great head start on them. And so from The time that they won, which was, I think, just before midnight on the 27th of October until, I think, November 9th, all I did was work on the book. And by November 9th, it's 13 days later, the book was in between covers with the jacket on it.
Wow.
Which is just amazing. So they had it ready for the Black Friday sales. But that shows you where you are in the hierarchy of publishing. There's no doubt. You know, when I handed a novel, they're like, you know, we'll probably bring it out in 2 years. You know, 13 days.
13 days. Stuart Onan, we just had an election, and Obama was elected. I deal with the writers, and over the past 8 years, I've watched changes in the way people are writing. People who were never really overtly political, even someone like, say, Dennis Lehane, have become more political. Some people say, well, you know, only if it's in context, and others say, have said, and I've heard this, yes, it's in context, but I'm putting more in because I am so angry at what's happened over the past 8 years. There's been a change, and I'm just curious, from your point of view, do you think we're going to see a change in the arts over the next year or two? Because suddenly a lot of that anger is dissipated and people are going to be looking at different things?
It's hard to say. It's very hard to say. I mean, over, as a you know, wide, broad, sweeping generalization, there's always going to be a concern or a championing of justice and fairness and equality. That's America. That's the American promise. I mean, it was there in Mark Twain's writing. You know, it's there in Faulkner's writing. It's there in Cheever's writing. It's there in Tim O'Brien's writing. It's going to be there in the writing this year and next year, you know, 20 years, 100, 200 years from now. It's what America's founded on, you know, fairness and equality and justice. And we've been in such an unjust situation in the last, especially in the last 8 years, and glaringly unjust. Just a great example is, throughout the campaign, there were all these small sort of innuendos about association and guilt and things like that. Very small, tiny, you know, itty-bitty, tenuous relations between one candidate and perhaps other people. While Dick Cheney, the CEO of Halliburton, have been working out the no-bid shit for years. And the last 8 years, the guys didn't care. They didn't care how it looked. They said, we're in power, we got it, so screw you. And we can do anything we want. So I'm hoping there's a change in the next, you know, 4, 8, 12, 16, 20, you know, however long. But obviously we're more hopeful now.
Yeah.
You know, the country's more hopeful. People are happier. But at the same time, remember, you know, Obama got what, 52%, 51%? You know, there's still, you know, 48, 49% that voted for the other guy who are not happy. You know, it's an odd country. It's so variegated. It's so different because it's so damn big. There's so many different cultures, different values. And that's good. That's great. And I'd love us to see the country go to something that's more representative, you know, a parliamentary-type government where, you know, the people that are, you know, hardcore Second Amendment people, they have their own party with their own representatives. And then you have other people, you know, who have their own, you know, what they want and have their own representatives so that then they'll have to deal with each other. Right now we have these sort of two monolithic parties that when it comes to election time, they have to pretend that they hold certain things to get all these other little people in. You know, why not represent us a little more directly there so we have some voice? I know how painful it is not to have any voice in Washington or in, you know, a state senate. So maybe more representative government. Will that ever happen?
No, probably not.
But I wish for it. When I see how the English system works or how the German system works, I think it's a better solution.
You write about regionalism, and when I travel, if I'm in Idaho or if I'm in Ohio and I just look at, or California, and I just look at the stores and I look at the lobsters, it all seems the same. But I think you're suggesting in books like Songs from the Missing that maybe regionalism still does exist.
Of course it exists. How your town is, how your town feels. You know, obviously, you know, walking the streets of Berkeley is very, very different than walking the streets of, say, Hartford. Being in Chicago is very different from being in Phoenix, or even in the suburbs. Yes, there's some cosmetic similarities between places. But, I mean, just look at the people that work at, you know, a Red Lobster. They're going to be different. If you go to a Red Lobster in, say, South Dakota, the people that work there are going to be very different from the people that work at the Red Lobster in Georgia.
And you did that research.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And which was great. You know, it was a lot of fun.
Did he get tired of the menu?
Fun to do. A little bit. A little. It's a limited menu. But it's just you know, you got to remember, people are they're different everywhere, and what they want is somewhat the same. You know, they want a decent job, a job they can be proud of, a job they can do well, a job that pays them so they can do the things that they want to do for themselves and for their children. That's that sort of, you know, very, very basic level. And sometimes the work is on that basic level, but I think can speak to a larger political concern. You don't have to get up and, you know, get on the soapbox and beat it. When the Red Lobster's closing down, you know times are tough.
One final question. Stuart Onan, now you've finished Songs for the Missing. It's come out. Are you working on another novel?
Yeah. I'm about halfway through, maybe a little further halfway through. It's actually a sequel to Wish You Were Here. It's about Emily, one of the protagonists of Wish You Were Here, and she's, I think, in her late 70s, about 78 years old. So it's a novel about an old lady.
And that brings up the idea of sequels. I mean,
yeah.
Do you ever feel like you look at these characters, say, in Songs for the Missing and going, you know, 5 years from now, I wonder what Lindsay will be doing?
Yeah, and sometimes you say, I'm not really done with that character yet. I want to go back and find out more about them. And sometimes you go back, and as you're finding more about them, you find somebody else. And that somebody else takes off, and you're off somewhere else. You never quite know what you're going to do when you start a book. You know, you think you go one way, and then you go the other. That's the exciting thing. The exciting thing is when you sort of just peel off and go somewhere you never thought you'd go before. I never thought I'd write a sequel. You know, if you look at the books, they're all very different. And here I am, you know, back with Emily 8 years later. So it's a lot of fun. In fact, they're about to do the Pennsylvania primary in her book. And she has to go back through time and remember all the different people that she voted for or voted against and why and where it's taken her and her thinking this may be the last election that she ever has.
Do you think that because we went through this season, that's been on your mind, you've got to do this?
No, I knew I'd have to do this. It was in terms of the scope, the time frame of her story. I knew it was going to go through April in 2008, and it just so happened that the Pennsylvania primary became very important. Usually, it wouldn't have been important at all. In looking back at Emily's life and in the fullness of her life, she's addressing a lot of different questions, and some of those questions are political because she lived through, you know, the Depression and World War II, and she has memories of all these things and all the great, you know, issues of the day that nowadays people know nothing about.
Gore Vidal said this is the United States of amnesia.
Yeah. Well, that's how she feels about it. She carries it along with all of her other memories of Pittsburgh and the way Pittsburgh had been in the past.
You've been listening to an interview with Stuart Onan, whose latest novel is Songs for the Missing. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.